Hi, I'm novelist and critic Kim Newman.
And I'm writer and editor Stephen Jones.
And this is our third and last commentary track for a season three Night Gallery episode, The Doll of Death, which comes from a short story which is rather less well known, or at least the author is rather less well known than many of the writers whose Night Gallery episodes we've been picking up on. But Steve, you think that Vivian Meek is a particularly interesting character.
You know, it's fascinating. I knew who Meek was because this story comes from a collection of his called Devil's Drums, which was published in 1933 as one of the Philip Allen's Creep series of anthologies edited by Charles Birkin. Those are worth a lot of money now if you can find them. And this particular book, this collection, had 10 linked African voodoo stories, actually including a story called White Zombie, which has nothing to do with the movie. And so this was a pretty obscure story. But as you know, Kim, the reason that obviously Night Gallery got it was that it got reprinted. And in fact, the only time it's been reprinted that I'm aware of was in the Sixth Pan Book of Horror Stories in 1965.
Yeah,
and they pulled other stuff from that
Basil Copper's Camera Obscura, which was an episode we also did a commentary track.
Season two, yeah.
Actually, just after the Copper story, there's Party Games by John Burke, which was adapted for a British TV
by
show called Late Night Horror. It was a little before Night Gallery. They adapted Richard Matheson's No Such Thing as a Vampire. A terrific adaptation of Robert Aitman's Ringing the Changes.
Yep.
And most of that is lost, although the John Burke episode survives. But if you look at it, it's like a British Night Gallery
from
3 years earlier.
And I got to say, the best painting of the three we've done, I think, as well, on this one. But yeah, Vivian Bernard Meek was born in Calcutta in British India in 1894. And he died in San Clemente, California in 1955. So even by this period, you know, he's well out of favour and most people don't even know who he is. He claimed to be born at sea in a British vessel, which I thought was quite interesting, and then went on to become a diplomatic journalist for The People in London and the Glasgow Sunday Post newspapers. He moved to London, lived in Hampstead Garden suburb, which, as you know, Kim, is not a cheap place to live in, even back then, in North London. And he actually lost his left eye during the Blitz in London. So he already had quite a colourful life, right? But when I was doing some research on him, he did have a lot of books. He wrote a book called The People of the Leaves, which was his first book for Philip Allen in 1931, in which he claimed to have discovered an obscure tribe of primitive Aborigines who were living in a weird, obscure East Coast part of the Indian subcontinent. Then he did a novel called Veils of Fear, which is another one of the Philip Allen Creep series, and then a book called The Curse of Red Shiva in 1936. His final book was a small polemic, The Nemesis Over Hitler, in 1941. So he wasn't really much of a writer, you know, a handful of books and that, he was done. But when I was researching him for this, I discovered a really fascinating piece in the British National Archives. As a journalist, he falsely claimed to have been employed by British intelligence during the war and was convicted under the Official Secrets Act in 1943 for improperly obtaining documents from a Foreign Office employee, along with a woman called Gwendolyn Ayres. And both were sentenced to 2 years imprisonment under the Official Secrets Act in the 1940s, which obviously explains that when he got out, he decided to move to America because whatever. He actually joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1946. And then he moved his family to Salt Lake City and applied for permanent residency in the US in 1947. So obviously he was fed up with England and came to America after the war. Now, I actually couldn't find out much more about him. But the only other interesting thing I found was there was a photo in the files of Mr. and Mrs. Vivian Meek discussing the White House renovation with John R. Steelman, who was actually President Truman's chief assistant in the White House. So these guys, well, he obviously moved in high circles. Remember, he died in 1955. But he was obviously a bit of a mover and shaker, was Meek, or shall we say, a con man, I get the sense of.
A buccaneering rogue.
Who would write stories, write novels, write newspaper articles. A bit of an Edgar Wallace about him is what I think.
This floating around the empire and international.
Well, I mean, I've got to say, Devil's Drums, all the stories are like this. They're all that sort of, you know, what we used to call old club stories.
They are kind of Somerset Maugham, but with scary stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of people did those. Even Robert Louis Stevenson was doing that back in the day.
This isn't Night Gallery's only voodoo episode. The story is set in Africa, and this is set in the West Indies.
I know Rod Serling says at the beginning it's set in the West Indies, but I don't think it is. I think the story is actually set in Africa, and he gets that wrong in his introduction. There is nothing here that says... In fact, it doesn't play like the West Indies at all. It does play like Africa. Yeah. To a certain extent, especially when you've got you've got Jean Durand as Alex, the manservant, who is obviously African. He's not Indian, and certainly the feeling you get, there's not a lot of sitting around drinking gin on verandas in this or whatever. Yeah. I think this actually was shot certainly, by John Badham, who I think does a terrific job on this as an African story. And they just look, all these people are African; they're not Indian.
Yeah.
West Indian. I think they're, and I think that was the interesting thing about the stories that Meek wrote. You didn't get a lot of stories set on the African continent.
You get here, which is slightly unusual for 1971, is here we are with the colonial upper class, and obviously you have the black servant, but there are black people among the guests as well. You see, as it were, in the background there, upper-class black people.
Well, the argument is, although the story was published originally in 1933...
And we have to say, like all the stories, it's hideously racist.
Oh, it is. Yeah. But is this set in 1933, or is it set in a later period? I think this is actually set in a later period.
Yeah, because he talks about Harold Pinter and credit cards and stuff. But the
way they behave is as you say.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's minimally updated. I'd say the original casting on this was Barbara Parkins, but she fell off a horse.
Maybe in that very scene.
Possibly. Yeah, and refused to go on, so they got Susan Strasberg, who looks exactly like Barbara Parkins
at that time. I always think of Barbara Parkins as being a slightly more dour actress than Susan Strasberg.
She was, I suppose. Watching this, it's the first time I'd really noticed that Susan Strasberg is tiny.
When she's standing next to her.
That's right. Whereas I think of Barbara Parkins as tall and willowy, but that may just be the roles she's played. Yeah, we've all been surprised.
Susan Strasberg to me, like Tisha Sterling in that earlier episode, is one of those sexy hippie chick women from the early 70s, late 60s, 80s,
and
she's
reconceived from the stories. Abused wife into a wild child, free spirit. The husband in the story is a brutal monster. He's kind of like Kurtz, isn't he? He's gone native.
He has gone native very early on.
Yeah. Whereas Barry Atwater, you sort of see his point.
Well, he's not the main villain in this. No, he's the guy who does the worst things, but he's not pushed into doing this. And of course, Barry Atwater, who I think is terrific in this, is best known for all of us, playing the vampire in the Kolchak pilot, The Night Stalker,
where he has no dialogue and he's very briefly seen. In fact, there is no particular reason they couldn't have cast a stuntman in that role, but they got an actor, which was the right call.
And he's got a weird look to him as well, hasn't he?
I always think his nose looks false, but actually it's not. He's got a nose like that.
But this was his only Night Gallery episode, interestingly enough.
And Alejandro Rey was apparently also a last-minute casting. The character in the story is British, but he's been rewritten as a... I have to say, one of the things... He's referred to as filthy and dirty and grimy, but actually those are the cleanest white outfits.
I guess they couldn't get Alex Cord for this role as well, because he plays the same role in earlier episodes of Night Gallery and that same kind of thing.
I think that Ray is kind of... We're supposed to sort of like him, but actually we don't.
No, I think both of them are not particularly pleasant and kind of... deserve what you're going to get, to be honest. Yeah. I know it's a terrible thing to say. But it's what you were saying earlier on about how horror was changing at this period in the early 70s. Mm. And, the twist ending where they, the people do get their... The hero and heroine do die and get their comeuppance a lot of the time. That sort of miserablest horror, as it were.
Yeah.
It's just starting to come in. But, I've got to say, compared to the story, I don't really blame Barry Atwater as Alex Brandon for being, getting his revenge on these two. Because, they basically... She leaves him at the altar, which doesn't happen in the story.
Obviously, Jack Gus, who did the adaptation, not... somebody who's got much of a track record in horror, but I know you're a big fan of Lady in Cement.
I do. I love Lady in Cement. One of my favourite Frank Sinatra detective movies.
He could easily have stuck by the story and established early on that the husband was a brutal thug.
Yeah, and in fact, the story of all the stories on here is the most easily to adapt into a night gallery episode.
But he chooses not to do that.
Yeah.
And even here where he's torturing the guy, you see a sort of... Yeah, an ambiguity about it. He's not sure if it's going to work, and he's not, and he doesn't go through with it. You know, he's not sticking pins in it. Yeah,
I also think he has one of these terrible voodoo dolls, just like those ones in Asylum from Amicus. So, you know, they don't look very much like the person they're meant to be.
Yeah, there was a weird thing where Barry Atwater got the tonight's guest stars include, but Murray Matheson got the billing on the actual credits.
Yeah, well, I've always liked Murray Matheson. He was a little fussy Australian born actor.
Yeah.
Made his screen debut in the mid-40s, but in everything. I mean, one of those guys who turned up in everything.
He's a regular in the George Peppard show, Banachek, another Universal thing from around this period that I find... it seemed ordinary then, but it's absolutely relishable now in terms of...
I like a lot of these shows. I think it's interesting. I mean, he's really standout role. He played the clown in the Twilight Zone episode, Five Characters in Search of an Exit in 1961. And that really sort of put him on the map, which I think is kind of interesting. And his last film role was in the Kick the Can segment of Twilight Zone the movie in 1983.
He'd done a couple of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and some thrillers.
Yeah.
And
oh, he's done everything.
Like he ticked all those... those boxes.
And he was again, in the story, Meek's story, he is the main character of the story. He's the one that we're meant to sympathise with.
Does his character run throughout the series?
The Doctor character, no, I don't think he actually runs all the way through
but
the series.
But he feels like that.
He feels like a continuing character. But the interesting thing here, he's not a particularly pleasant character in this either. And in fact, his last piece of dialogue is downright nasty, to be honest with you, and basically racist and everything. Yeah. I mean, he's not a pleasant character in this. Whereas I think Barry Atwater does come across as quite urbane and obviously mad as a box of cats, but and of course here's the Murder She Wrote Pier from Universal Backlot.
I believe that the creature from the Black Lagoon was sighted on that very same stretch of
and
water.
Nowadays you can get the Jaws shark popping up on that same thing.
Somewhere in this room I have a bottle of water from that lake that David Scow
I think we've all got one of those,
hands out as Black Lagoon water. It is obviously a...
So let's talk a bit about John Badham, who directed this, the British-born actor who's still around at the time of this recording as well. I mean, again, made his start in TV, went on to do a whole bunch of big movies, and then ended up going back to TV again.
Yeah, obviously something didn't work out for him in the A-list, as it were. I mean,
he did six night galleries.
He seems to be the guy who you go to after Richard Donner passes, isn't it? He was like, he had that kind of, and I think he was I remember clocking his name on the night galleries and thinking he was really one of the talented directors. He also did a TV movie called Isn't It Shocking, which I really like.
Which is great fun,
And he worked on this James Garner Western show, The Nichols, which is really interesting. Plus, he directed a couple of episodes of The Sixth Sense, which got folded into Night Gallery.
It's basically the same creative team.
And then he made a sort of big screen debut. I think it's... He also remade Diabolique for television as Reflections of Murder. It's the Bingo Long Travelling All-Stars and Motor Kings, which is an interesting little picture. And then he's got this run. It's Saturday Night Fever, The Frank Langella Dracula, Whose Life Is It Anyway, Blue Thunder, War Games, Short Circuit, Stakeout, Bird on a Wire, The Hard Way, Point of No Return, which is the remake of Nikita. And
he was the archetypal 80s director.
Yeah, that's right. He's not an auteur. He's not a Spielberg or a Lucas or a De Palma. But he is, in the 80s, he's the guy you put into... And I know, for instance, on War Games, he replaced Martin Bregman at the last minute.
Right.
He was clearly a studio guy.
Absolutely.
Whereas, you can say early on, maybe looking at Saturday Night Fever and Dracula back to back. What kind of personality is
Well, I think he's a director who basically, as you say, one of those workman like directors who got their start in TV, and their job was to direct a Western one week, a horror thing the next week, a science fiction thing the next week. So he could turn his hand to almost any of these shows. And they are, and when you talk about Saturday Night Fever or Dracula or Blue Thunder or War Games, they're all very different films.
Yeah.
And you don't think of them as being all being directed by the same guy.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, when he went back into TV and he did some episodes of Psych, which I very much like as a TV series, he did a lot of Supernaturals as well.
And then he did The Shield and Heroes.
And Siren, that weird mermaid
episode
show
of Constantine,
well.
12 Monkeys, the show Arrow. So
he's obviously back doing, you know, he's on the treadmill again, just doing episodic TV.
He's still working.
Yeah.
I suppose there is you can see that there's a period, and it's another stakeout when he makes the sequel to a film that nobody remembers, so even fewer people remember. And then it's like there are a run of big movie star type projects. I remember Nick of Time with Johnny Depp and Christopher Walken was press shown but not released in Britain, and then it came out on video. So that's the sort of
career arc.
The peak and the slow. But he's always good. I don't quite know why he stopped getting the good, the good projects.
Maybe because they were looking for auteurs now and whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, the one thing about TV is it teaches you to direct quickly and accurately.
Yeah.
Because you're on a short video, you probably is shot in 5 days or something. And he could do that. He had that ability to do that. But again, he was what I was talking about earlier. He's a transitional director. He's one of these new guys coming in. And Night Gallery, who were very good, and they used people like George Wagner and whatever for the early episodes, are now saying, okay, who are the new guys? Who are the guys who are coming up in TV? And I think Badham did that. And every one of these episodes he's directed for Night Gallery has a different feel.
Our late good friends, Chris Wicking and Thais Bahamagi, wrote a book called The American Vein about directors of episodic television. And I remember them highlighting, and I remember getting that book, and also it was the first time I started checking who directed episodes of The Rockford Files.
Yeah.
Because you knew if it was William Weird, it was probably going to be one of the good ones. And Jeannot Schwarke and John Badham were the Night Gallery directors.
They absolutely
that
were.
You thought, I don't know if they were getting the best scripts or the best guest stars.
I don't think it mattered. Or they would bring their own.
It's entirely possible
skills.
That this isn't the best script.
No, I don't think it is.
But he's working. And you're right about Susan Strasberg. She should have been a much bigger star than she was.
Oh, she really should have been.
I don't know if it was the fact she came from an acting dynasty. Obviously, from. In our genre, we think of her in Scream of Fear.
Early Hammer film with Christopher Lee,
And actually, she's the ingenue in that. So, and that was like 12 years before this.
Yes.
And she's still playing a character who you credibly believe is in her early 20s.
But, you know,
naive.
I mean, she's also in those two Corman AIP movies, The Trip and Psych Out.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it was the hippie chick.
Yeah,
that's
I think she got interested in that time. I mean, obviously, coming from an unconventional family. But she has a ton of interesting credits.
Well, Satan's Triangle, the TV movie, I love. The Swarm, which, of course, is...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm talking the wrong one. Sorry. Legend of Hillbilly John.
Yes, that's right.
Which is really interesting. Manny Wade Wellman's story.
Yeah.
And The Manitou, of course, based on the,
yes,
on the book
right.
by Graham Masterton.
Yeah, where she has a fetus hatch out of her.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she, I mean, she obviously, you know, was up for doing some oddball things, which I think is kind of interesting.
In the meantime, it is Macmillan and Weiss' wife and Harry O, The Rockford Files a couple of times. And there was a period in the 70s where a lot of male-led shows needed high-quality leading lady guest stars. Mariette Hartley, Jessica Walter, Margot Kidder for a while. And Susan Strasberg was one of those. They would turn up, be amazing in an episode, usually as somebody who had a whirlwind romance with James Garner, then dumped him at the end and left him heartbroken. Yeah. And she is much more appealing than the character she is playing here.
Oh, yeah.
Who is... if this character had been played by Sandra Locke, who did quite a lot of roles like this, you'd hate her. Because Sandra Locke was really good at being self-involved and slightly evil hippie chick.
Yeah.
Whereas,
and also she had a slight edge of craziness to her performances, yeah, which of course Susan Sarandon doesn't have. Susan Strasberg. Susan Strasberg doesn't have in this.
Susan Sarandon did hippie chick roles too.
Yeah, you see, they're all the same from this period. Yeah. But no, I think she's very... I mean, she's only her second Night Gallery, and she died of breast cancer in 1999 at the age of 60, which is such a tragedy, because I thought she was a terrific actress, to be honest. But I think this is, a particularly well-cast Night Gallery.
She did have a final credit in 2018. She's in Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, which would have been filming around the time of this.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And probably for years after. But also, the fact she's in that suggests that she was able to live in the two worlds of absolutely bread-and-butter commercial TV and the slightly weirder fringe Sunset Strip, Venice Beach.
I think Legend of Hillbilly John is absolutely one of those weird off the radar movies. So really was Psych Out on the Trip, if you think about it, back in the day. They were low-budget movies. But again, talking about the Joe Alves set design, look at that. I mean, that's
particularly because we've seen this particular staircase quite often, I think. Yeah.
I'm just impressed how Barry Atwater's hairpiece never moves in this.
Yes, no. It's glued to his forehead. A remarkable... It's kind of Dana Carvey look hairpiece, isn't it? Yeah.
But, I mean, the use of flowers and it's just a beautifully put together
spotlighting. Shot. And yet, in terms of the scary, the horror stuff, it's kind of spinning its wheels until we get to the gruesome finish, isn't it? Which is, it's a very similar gruesome finish to the Sweets of the Sweet episode of The House That Dripped Blood with Christopher Lee and Chloe Franks, which also depends on something horrible being done to a doll seeing what happens.
But
to
this is actually one of the rare occasions where I do think the story is better than the adaptation, actually. I think the story is more linear in many ways. And I think it tells its story, tells its tale in a much neater way. I think this jumping back and forth between all these characters does tend to make it a bit confusing. Yeah. And I think the one character we didn't talk about who's only got very little screen time in this is Henry Brandon, who plays Verica, who is was my favourite Dr. Fu Manchu in the serial Drums of Fu Manchu.
And he was Scar in The Searchers.
He had the most amazing career.
And here he is. He gets like two or three lines.
I think he gets two or three lines. He's in the background at the wedding, and I think he turns up again in a minute. Yeah. It's his only Night Gallery. But what I was saying before about the fact that this is the end of that period of horror film making. You know, his first film was Cecil B. DeMille's Sign of the Cross in 1932. And he played that Dr. Caligari-like guy, Silas Barnaby, in that Laurel and Hardy comedy, March of the Wooden Soldiers. Because he was a German actor. He's a German-born actor. His real name was Heinrich von Kleinbach. So you see why he changed his name to Henry Brandon.
Yeah. I remember him as Ben Gunn in The Land Unknown, or the Ben Gunn character in The Land Unknown.
And his last film was Wizards of the Lost Kingdom in 1989, Wizards of the Lost Kingdom number 2 in 1989. Yeah. So he had a very long career. And he, as I say, great, great character actor. Career's dating back to the early 30s. And yet in this, you almost feel like there was more. And in the story, his character has a lot more to do. Because he's the guy who points out what was going on and knew what was going on all the way through it.
I wonder if maybe there was a script draft that was much closer to the story and they cast from that and then rewrote. Because the stresses are all wrong.
Yes, they are.
And that weird thing about changing who's actually a star and who's a supporting player between the opening pictorial montage and the credits.
Yeah.
It just feels as if they're hesitating.
But we also know that Jack Gus could do this because he co-wrote the miniseries The Dark Secret of Harvest Home in 1978 that was based on the novel by Tom Tryon. And that's actually a pretty faithful adaptation of that book as well. And it's multi-character and multi-generational again. Yeah. So
I think maybe losing the two lead actors during and having to replace. Yeah. And this works a lot less well than the ending of that episode in The House That Dripped Blood.
It does.
Where you just see the melting doll on the fire and hear... Do you even hear a scream? But you get a sense of what's happening to Christopher Lee.
And I don't think you get that from this at all. I think they didn't quite get this one.
In fact, the broken head is good.
But you need to see his broken head.
That's right. We can't then pan... to a head that isn't broken.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's one. I get this, and the ring, which is not even in the story, yeah. is what she put on the doll to make it.
Yeah,
him.
It's a drop of blood in the story, which is much better.
Much, much better. Yeah, yeah. And much more in keeping with the actual, you know, black magic rites as well. Yeah. But I mean, overall, not the worst episode yeah. I've ever seen.
And Alejandro Rey, who we've not talked about, manages to get bare chested throughout, and there he is again in his very clean. Beach bum outfit.
Yeah. Still looking like Alex Cord with that moustache, yes. as far as I'm yeah. concerned. But hey. But yeah, not the worst at all. I think it's one of those treading water episodes.
Yeah.
But the story itself, I think, you know, Vivian Meek's story, much more interesting than and deserved better in this one.
Yes, track it down.
But once again, thank you for listening to us drone on during another Night Gallery episode. Not the best season, maybe, but certainly maybe the most interesting season, yeah. Kim. Would you agree?
I think it is interesting, and I think because we've seen it less often, it can surprise us more, because we're not as familiar with these stories as we are with the first two seasons.
So there you go. Check it out.